I'm Brittany Harden-Tengue, a senior manager with KPMG, and I am fascinated by the practice of transfer pricing and its impact on the global market. Join me each episode as I explore the transfer pricing world with specialists who will explain the ins and outs of this niche practice where tax meets economics. On today's podcast, we have a very special listener request for this episode, and we're going to be talking about the importance of intercompany agreements. I had a client ask this question, and I thought it was a good one to address to essentially answer the question, why are intercompany agreements important for taxpayers who have transfer pricing? I went to the NABE conference, the National Association for Business Economics Transfer Pricing Symposium, in the summer of 2024, and asked a number of very thoughtful folks, what is the importance of intercompany agreements? Why do they think this is important? And why do we have these within our business and companies, et cetera, et cetera? And so I have with me to explore some of these topics and to listen and react to what I heard from these folks, Mark Horowitz, who is a principal from our Tax Controversy and Dispute Resolution Group at KPMG and sits in Houston. So welcome, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. So without further ado, we're going to listen to the first clip from Barb Montagani, and we'll see what she has to say. And Mark, get your reaction. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right.
I think that you cannot predict the future of everything, particularly when we were a competent authority. Yes, we considered and looked at, and with the treaty partner, the parties had this contractual agreement. But if the actual transactions as they occurred didn't seem to be consistent with what a third party would have agreed to if they had in fact had the secret look into the future, then we would take that into consideration, that you have to be realistic. And contracts always have, again, the other terms and conditions as required sort of thing. But particularly in this space, there's always the challenge. And I've been doing this for so long that often when I first started doing this, there were transactions that didn't have an actual written contract, that you'd get the, we've always done it that way. And so I think that it is important to have an intercompany contract that describes a methodology and sort of results that you could figure that third parties would enter into. But even third parties, if I'm just starting in an industry, I might have to sign a contract that doesn't necessarily give me the best deal I could get.
That's an excellent point that Barb has made. This is an evolution. Intercompany agreements did not always necessarily exist, but there's become a need, right? So Mark, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this.
I agree 100% that today, at least for material transactions, there is a need for an intercompany agreement. And the reason that we do need intercompany agreements in the vast majority of cases today is because we're living in a new world where the ex ante allocation of risk really matters. And there's a ton of challenges to either based on economic substance or based on DEMPI concepts or based on risk control concepts. When I say DEMPI, I'm of course referring to the development, enhancement, maintenance, protection, and exploitation of intangibles. So when we have uncertainty in the transfer pricing system, we really need intercompany agreements, at least to put that flagpole down to say, this is the company's position on those concepts, right? Economic substance, allocation of risk, control of risk, DEMPI, at least the basics. Another thing that Barb mentioned is what tax authorities do or what they look at. She mentioned her time at the tax authority. And there is a spectrum of how tax authorities look at intercompany agreements and how much deference or respect that intercompany agreements are given by different tax authorities in APA context, advanced pricing agreements, or especially the MAP context, the mutual agreement procedure under tax treaties, otherwise known as competent authority, and certainly at the exam phase. So something to take into account, but the punchline is it's really important to have intercompany agreements, especially in the new world we've been living in for the past 5 to 7+ years and the world we expect to be in for the foreseeable future.
That's a great point. And I think another thing she mentioned as well that's good to keep in mind is you want to get them as fair as you can, but in the beginning, even if you're entering into a third party agreement, you may not get it right away, right? So revisiting those is important too, which we'll talk a little bit more about that. So let's listen to the next one. On the subject of risk, I think that's what David Farhat from Skadden will be sharing the next clip with us.
I think when you're looking at risk control, you always start with your intercompany agreements. And I think one of the things that tax authorities have found lacking is that the contracts don't clearly delineate risk. And if they do, they find that there may not be substance in the entity that is bearing the risk. And that might be a bit of an old school concept. And now you don't have these contracts sending risk to Sunny Island somewhere, but they're sending it to other treaty partners. So not being clear in how risk is delineated, how losses are handled, can be very problematic. So if we're looking at intercompany agreements, I think folks need to be very clear as to who bears risk and what's going to happen when those risk events are realized.
Intercompany agreements, you usually go by the wayside. You spend a lot of time preparing and focus on agreements that are happening with third parties to make sure that you get the protection that's necessary. And on top of that, businesses tend to be very optimistic about about what will happen and maybe won't have as robust of a risk section in those intercompany agreements. So do you have any sort of thoughts or advice or ways for people to think about how to practically go about ensuring that they have a robust assessment of what could possibly be happening?
Yeah, without a doubt. But I don't think that's limited to just the intercompany agreements, right? Because I think the intercompany agreement should delineate that. But I think we have to take another step and look at everything we're going to be sharing with the tax authority in totality, right? So your documentation. And I honestly, following your agreements. I think, you know, that becomes more important because I've seen when I was with the IRS, we would see some wonderfully tailored agreements, but then you do some interviews and you realize, well, your agreement says A and you're doing B. So it's not just kind of documenting these things, but also following these things. Because, I mean, the tax authorities are coming in on an ex ante basis. They look at your agreements and they look at behavior. And if those don't match, you give them incentive to kind of go away from the agreement and go into facts and circumstances, functions, all of these other things that we talk about that cause problems. So one, have your agreements. Two, make sure your documentation covers everything.
All right. So the role of risk and substance. I think that's an excellent point that he made. Mark, what do you think?
I agree that ex ante risk allocation, putting it in the agreement, is very important. I've seen tons of intercompany agreements where it's not 100% clear what the risk allocation is in terms of who is the principal, who is bearing the really key business risks. That's really important to put in the agreement. One thing that I would note, though, is that that's true for the relatively simple questions and situations where it's not that difficult to identify who is bearing the risk. The difficulty is putting the detail in intercompany agreements for the unforeseen circumstances or extraordinary transactions. And that's really, really difficult to do. Obviously, you can try to do it, but it's very, very difficult to foresee every single circumstance or event that can occur. What we try to do is build some flexibility into the agreement. So when there is unforeseen or extraordinary issues, that we can have some flexibility in how the transfer pricing reacts to the intercompany agreement. But at the end of the day, it's very important to have some risk allocation concepts and clear delineation of functions in your intercompany agreement.
That's a great point, Mark. And when we think about intercompany agreements as being part of the library of documentation and evidence of compliance that you have in advance, what we see more often in our transfer pricing documentation reports is the example of COVID being a risk. I don't know how many risk sections prior to 2020 included who would be responsible for certain functions or activities in response to a global pandemic. And obviously that threw a wrench in everything. And now I feel like every time I pick up a documentation report, you do see some sort of acknowledgement of that risk. Now with intercompany agreements, I know that's something that we have advised folks to consider revisiting, but these agreements obviously don't get updated as frequently as your transfer pricing documentation, but it's still something to keep in mind that maybe we should be acknowledging more of these risks as they become available. Let's talk a bit about following the intercompany agreements. I think that's super critical. It's one thing to have it written down, but we need to make sure that what we're saying is actually what we're doing, right?
It's both following the agreement and implementing what you say you're going to do, both in terms of the risks, but also the functions, right, and the substance. But it also goes back to what we were discussing about the flexibility of the agreement. Because if you have very explicit things that need to occur in an agreement, this could be the termination clause of the agreement being very explicit and inflexible, or the timing of payments. I've seen a lot of times where taxpayers get tripped up by that because they don't exactly follow the agreement. So that's a situation where the level of detail in the agreement and inflexibility in the agreement doesn't really help you. So I'm a proponent of having intercompany agreements a little bit more flexible and a little bit higher level in some instances. As we say, less is more.
Because there's a cost to it, right? I mean, it's not nothing to put together an intercompany agreement. And so you want it to last for a long time, I would imagine, in a number of scenarios. And so exactly that, making it flexible enough to meet the needs so that you're not overthinking it, but still getting your bases covered. Great. Let's listen to the next one.
Speaking with my competent authority hat on, you didn't ignore intercompany agreements, but to the extent that they didn't seem to reflect the arm's length nature of the actual transactions that occurred, you dealt with the actual transactions.
Back to Barb and putting on the competent authority hat. What are your thoughts there, Mark?
What she's referring to is the fact that when you're in a competent authority negotiation, and that would include APAs, that different tax authorities are going to have different views on the intercompany agreement and on the risk allocation. And so it's just part of a negotiation. That said, we were discussing earlier the importance of having an intercompany agreement. If you don't have one at all, or if it's imperfect, then the tax authorities are going to have carte blanche to really argue whatever they want. And so you certainly want to have a solid intercompany agreement. But Barb does raise a good point that in a MAP case, even frankly at the exam phase with IRS or other tax authorities, you can't assume that the tax authorities are going to exactly follow your intercompany agreement.
That is an excellent point. I don't know that I'd really ever thought about it that way, because there may arise the question from a taxpayer saying, why do I need to write an intercompany agreement? It is highly unlikely that I am going to get into a dispute with a related party. You know, so isn't that the point of having the contract, to be able to protect yourself and then the agreement? But in some regards, who you will have a dispute with will be the tax authority. So making sure that there is enough, like you said, flexibility that it can meet the needs, but also that it's specific enough so that if ever challenged, like you said, under exam or in a MAP or an APA case, that it's specific enough to make sure that the intent was clear and that the different perspectives from the tax authorities aren't going to sway what the outcome is, right?
Yep, I agree.
All right, let's listen to the next one. And this one, actually, we're going to hear from a taxpayer perspective.
So actually, what we do at Rent Company is that we meet with legal, our CFO from an international side, other stakeholders once a quarter, and also Treasury is involved in those conversations. And one of those topics that we talk about every quarter are intercompany agreements. We have a few loans that are set to expire. We had to refinance them, start that work ahead of time.
I think that's great. What do you think, Mark?
Obviously, as outside advisors, we aren't involved in the weeds of refreshing the agreement, but I can tell you that not refreshing them, while it's probably common, is definitely an issue that we see in tax controversies when agreements have not been updated, or worst case, not terminated when they should have been, or not assigned, or where the agreements haven't been treated consistently. In other words, some have been terminated or assigned and consideration paid, and some haven't been. Either way, creating them in the first place and then maintaining them or updating them, really critical.
Yeah, and building a process around it, making sure that they're staying current. I mean, that's a best practice, I think, for most taxpayers, because it can save you. It can make our job as advisors much easier down the line and make their experience a little less painful as well. All right, let's listen to the next one on best practices. We'll hear from Paul Sutton.
So the number one thing is just create a central repository of all your agreements. So a lot of groups have thousands, in some cases, of intercompany agreements, and they just need to put them in one place so they've got a handle on it.
Yeah, because when you need them, you need them. And you can never find all of them when the time is right. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So a central repository, having a robust organization system. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen that done well, Mark?
I've seen it done well, or rather I've sort of not seen it done well, because we don't really see it when it's done well. Our clients are just able to immediately get us the critical intercompany agreements. Where I remember it more vividly is when there's not a central repository, sometimes there are multiple departments or groups within a company that are keeping intercompany agreements, right? So for example, I've had several companies where some agreements are maintained by HR, some by tax, and some by legal. And the biggest issue, obviously, is employee mobility. When you don't have a central repository or multiple repositories and good file keeping practices and retention practices, when employees leave, you know, and you lose their email, it can be an issue. And that will be a huge issue in an exam, because if you can't find the signed agreement, it's basically like not having an intercompany agreement at all. And as we've discussed, if you don't have an intercompany agreement, you're giving carte blanche to the tax authority to take whatever position they want. And there's not much you can say about the ex ante allocation of risks and functions.
Yeah, that's a excellent observation. If it's done well, we don't know about it and it makes everything a lot easier. But there's nothing worse than during exam getting an information request and not being able to produce something that in fact does exist or finding that out later. It can put taxpayers in a very precarious situation. Let's hear the next one. So we'll hear from David again.
Same way that we will update a benchmarking to test the results, and we'll update our documentation. Sometimes we may not perform a functional interview every so often, but the last step in this is, if you're really going to be a responsible transfer pricing practitioner, have a responsible transfer pricing policies, to also include or revisit those agreements as part of that process on a pretty regular basis. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. Revisit the agreements and a mock audit. Talk to people. Are you following these agreements? You don't want surprises when the government comes in. You don't want someone in a functional interview to say, yeah, okay, I know the agreement says this, but we do that. So have those kinds of things. Make sure you're, like you say, refreshing to represent what's happening currently, if there's been some evolution, or making sure you know what's happening, and what's happening is what should be happening, right? So you stay on top of the business people, because we know as tax people, we're the tail, not the dog. So we have to make sure we understand folks are continually doing, quote unquote, what they're supposed to do.
A mock audit. So we're going through a lot of what will prepare taxpayers in this situation when these things are requested. David put it really well. Anything else to add, Mark, to this?
David was discussing mainly on the tail end, right? So when you have an intercompany agreement, what do you need to do to maintain it and refresh it and be audit ready? One thing to note is, if you build in some flexibility into your agreements, what we were discussing about flexibility, the benefit of flexibility and the benefit of not having sort of super detailed, inflexible terms, you often make your life easier in terms of maintaining it. It's also important when the agreement's being put together to have that discussion with the business of, hey, is this really what you guys are going to do? Are you going to be able to follow this agreement? So I think it's important to focus on that when you're creating the agreement. I see so many instances of companies rushing to get an agreement in place and trying to spend the minimum dollars on it. And you're just creating potential audit readiness issues for yourself down the road, as David was highlighting.
Excellent points. All right. And then our last one we'll listen to from Paul.
From our perspective, there's a huge discrepancy. So some large corporates are just incredible at their sophistication, you know, how they manage their agreements. Not only do they have sophisticated systems for creating and maintaining those agreements, but they also back them up by rules to say that they cannot book intercompany charges unless it's backed up by an agreement. So this is kind of hard enforcement of that. And so that's one end of the scale. Another end of the scale is groups that are still acting like it's 2020 or maybe 1990 or whatever, which is really paying lip service, and you're still seeing that in the course.
Okay, so yeah, there is definitely a scale. And this is connected to what we were discussing earlier about being audit ready. So your thoughts, Mark?
There's obviously a big spectrum when it comes to intercompany agreements and how much effort that companies put into creating the intercompany agreements and maintaining them and ensuring audit readiness. You certainly don't want to be on the side of doing too little. You know, on the flip side, I've seen instances where companies turn intercompany agreements almost into sort of an arm's length negotiation between different elements of the business and have the business folks heavily involved. And oftentimes that results in very idiosyncratic language in the agreements and very specific and detailed agreements, which isn't necessarily the best thing, as we've discussed previously. So there's a spectrum. You want to have a solid intercompany agreement. At the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
I love it. And that's a great way to end our episode today. So takeaways, lessons learned, like an insurance policy or preventative care, get your intercompany agreements, revisit them, make sure you're doing what they say. And it's all in service to making sure that you and your company are going to be audit ready. Any other closing thoughts, Mark, before we wrap up?
No, that was perfect.
Well, I really appreciate you joining me. Thanks again for your insights and for your reactions to our brilliant speakers. And many thanks to those who contributed to this episode, including Seth Salinger.
Thanks, Brittany.
Thanks for joining me on this adventure in transfer pricing. See you next time.